Hey everybody, before we get into the show, I do want to let you know that we have another live show coming up Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m. at Maya Cinemas in North Las Vegas. We are going to be talking about the vampire ballerina horror comedy Abigail. This movie looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. And joining me to talk about it are my wife, Gina Mazzoni, film student Perry Markle, and filmmaker and Sin City Horror Club founder Nick Woods. It's going to be a great time, great conversation. There's an enter to win contest going on right now on my website, piecingpod.com. You can find a link in the show notes. Enter to win some tickets. And otherwise, tickets are available from Maya Cinemas. And I hope to see you there on Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m. All right, welcome to another episode of Piecing It Together, or I should say, welcome to another episode of Breaking It Apart. This is our second episode of this new special series that we're doing here on the show. We didn't plan it this way, but this is the second time that one of these is going to happen when there's a re-release in theaters. I don't know how that worked out, but it did, and it's pretty sweet way to do things. But before we get into the episode, I do want to remind you guys at the top of the show, make sure you are subscribed to Piecing It Together on whatever your podcast app of choice is. You could also rate and review us on iTunes. That would be awesome. 5 stars would be even better. And follow us on social media at Piecing Pod. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You could also join our Facebook group, Piecing It Together, a movie discussion group, which I'm still wanting a new name for, but we haven't figured one out yet. We will one of these days. But right now, I've got more pressing issues getting my computers all back up and running. I told you a little bit about that last week during the 8th grade episode, and that's still happening. But, you know, we're kind of back up and running for the most part. Still got some issues I'm working out the kinks of. But it's kind of a perfect episode to talk about with my computer issues because my computer is basically turned into Hal and is trying to kill me, I think. But yeah, we are talking about 2001, A Space Odyssey. This is a Breaking It Apart, so of course we're doing the opposite direction of how Piecing It Together normally works. We're going to be looking at 2001 and figuring out what movies were inspired by it, which is not exactly a difficult thing to do. It is difficult, though, to narrow it down more so because there are so many movies that were inspired by 2001. I mean, the entire genre of sci-fi as it exists is basically, it's come from 2001. But as you'll hear in the conversation I have with returning guest Chris Cranock, who somehow, he did the Big Lebowski one with me too. So far, he's the only one who has done a Breaking It Apart episode with me. Which is funny because when I first came up with the idea of doing some backwards episodes like this, I talked to Ryan Daugherty about it, I talked to Chad Clinton Freeman about it, a couple other people as well. We'll get to those soon enough, but it just so happened to work out this way. And I'm glad it did because Chris is a huge, huge fan of Stanley Kubrick, and so it totally made sense for him to be the one to do this episode with me. And also, it gave him an opportunity to talk about an opportunity that he's had that has to do with Stanley Kubrick. So definitely listen for the end of our conversation where he gets into that. You're going to really want to hear this story. It's really pretty amazing. So without any further ado, I'd say let's jump right in and talk about 2001, Space Odyssey. All right, so back on the show with us again today, we've got Chris Cranock. Chris, glad to have you back.
I'm happy to be back.
All right,
number
man.
Number 5.
Yeah, is that right?
I think, yeah, this is number 5.
Man, I'm bad at keeping track of these
it's
things.
Okay. But I brought some champagne.
Okay, good, good, that's good. You also happen to be the only person I've done a Breaking It Apart with so far. We're planning on doing a bunch of these little special episodes, but It's cool that we're doing another one. I mean, you got plenty to say, I think, on this one.
Yeah, I'm totally fine with you not giving anyone else a chance to be a movie buff.
You're laying your claim on this thing right
I'm
now.
I'm totally fine with you not offering anyone else a chance. No, and this movie in particular is going to be... I'm excited. I'm really, truly excited to be able to talk about this guy.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And, of course, the movie we are talking about is 2001, A Space Odyssey. Stanley Kubrick's movie just was re-released in IMAX, and so I got a chance to see it there. You know, before we jump into any of it, it's funny. I think I told you this too. I had said that I haven't seen it since I was a kid, and I barely remember it, and blah blah blah. Then I'm sitting there in the theater, and just like it's all just unfolding in my eyes, and I'm like, did I ever see this? I think I would remember more of this, but I don't know. I still am not 100% sure if I saw it, but it was like a long time ago when I first saw it. It was really cool getting to finally see it for real, and especially in IMAX, because it was beautiful.
Yeah, for its 50-year anniversary, came back to IMAX. And what's funny, too, is why this is such a great film to talk about is kind of what you're describing, is that I think all of us think we've seen it because it's in everything we see.
Yeah.
Literally everything. Almost everything, I'll say. Almost everything. So it probably has the widest net of influence of any movie. Across genres, it's bled into our popular culture, and maybe we see it in commercials, we see it in TV shows that aren't science fiction.
This episode is going to be like minimum 3 hours, because we have so many movies to talk about.
I'm going to kind of pull like a Vladimir Nabokov and just have like a big butterfly net trying to capture all the influences we're going to talk about.
Yeah,
hour seven, I think we'll take a break, have an intermission. No, I'm going to keep it as concise as possible, I promise.
So 2001, obviously this is a movie, we're joking about all the movies that are influenced by it. I mean, really all of science fiction is so influenced by this movie.
Yeah.
Why do you think this is such an influential movie? What do you think makes that?
That's, that's starting off with a loaded question, because it's a perfect storm of a movie in terms of its influence and why it went on to become so crazy influential. So the first thing is that science fiction was not taken seriously in almost any realm, even literature. And we had Arthur C. Clarke, who was the co-creator and writer of the story of 2001, A Space Odyssey, who was writing pretty sophisticated science fiction, but it was a minority. And then there was the technical aspect of the movie, which was so far beyond anything we'd ever seen. 205 special effects images. Yeah. Which by today's standards is small, but back then was mind-numbingly amazing. In 1968,
the news probably has that much now.
Exactly. The fact that we are in the middle of the space race in the late 60s.
Yeah.
That was on all of our minds. That was the next great chapter. And then also too that it's so philosophical and artistic, even though it's so brilliantly technical. Mm-hmm. It's also such a poem. Kind of a poem of a film that it's kept people thinking about it and talking about it. And then the final thing I'll say is just the iconic imagery. The characters of Hal, for instance, have just kind of gone into our brains so deeply and penetrated fears that have only deepened as technology has increased. We were looking at AI, artificial intelligence, then in 1968, and it's only become more of a reality today. So, there's just a million reasons, and it was just the perfect place at the perfect time, and it seems to be the perfect movie.
It's also a huge risk-taking movie.
Oh, my goodness,
aside from the science fiction influence, I think any filmmaker that's come since then that wanted to really push the envelope, I mean, this is a major point in cinema,
Yeah, it's a strangely avant-garde movie. Yeah. That's the thing that, it's kind of it's famous Stargate sequences when, Dave goes down the wormhole, essentially. That was a huge hit with the hippie movement in the late 60s and the drug culture. They would go and just watch it on acid just to experience that scene alone.
Yeah.
And the movie was even repackaged and rebranded to help it sell better, because it was not doing very well until the youth market really saved it. So all these hippies were coming in, and they put the tagline on it, "The Ultimate Trip." And that was not by accident. It was to market to the drug culture. So, it's just it's a risk. It's a huge risk. Yeah. And I mean, some people consider it pretentious, of course, but I feel like it just struck a chord so deeply with what we're interested in about our origins and our species that I think it kind of transcends that that we've definitely warmed up to it. I think some audience members were polarized in the beginning, and now it's been recognized as, you know, universally great.
Sure.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we just want to go and experience. It still puts us in the stars. Like, it's the most, I've never been put more in the stars from a film than that film, including today.
Yeah. And also, because of the three acts, like they do such different, like, things. They take you to such different places. And so it kind of gives you a lot to chew on, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, rather than just one main story, you're getting these three things that are, of course, all, you know, connected, but
right.
They're visually and acting and storytelling.
Yeah,
and it's
conceptually.
Yeah, you know. It's a very, very interesting way of putting together so many different threads, mm-hmm. and which, again, is another thing that is, you know, a major influence on films that have come since.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, what's interesting about that film, too, is you're right, they're so different from each other, the portions.
Yeah.
And there is a lot. I mean, especially like on a philosophical level, we've been debating it for 50 years now.
Sure.
But really, if you really look at that movie, what's most astonishing to me is really how little it does.
Yeah.
There's not much that actually happens per se.
Sure.
The plot isn't convoluted. I mean, I could sum it up with, you know, within a minute of like the actual things that happen.
Which is also probably the biggest criticism, I think, of the movie,
yeah,
from people who don't like it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, I agree with that completely. Yeah. But it's, I mean, for people that are fans or people that admire, I mean, it's astonishing,
yeah,
with how potent such a small amount of stuff was. I mean, there's only 88 minutes of dialogue,
yeah,
in the entire film, which is two and a half hours with the intermissions.
Wow.
That there's no dialogue for the first 25 minutes and there's no dialogue for the last 25 minutes. And the dialogue that is there is somewhat irrelevant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically a silent film.
Yeah.
So to be able to be such a classic, almost like a classical film, where,
yeah,
I mean, it's, you know, telling a story purely visually, like the Chaplin era, and yet to make something so advanced that I think we're still behind it.
Sure.
I don't think we've caught up to 2001 yet.
It's crazy, man. It's so crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
Oh, man. Well, you know, before we get into any of these puzzle pieces, one question, and this is probably like a sin of film criticism, but do you have a favorite of the three segments of the film?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah, I do, certainly. Well, I'll just preface that by saying that I'm always in awe of the opening.
Yeah.
Because it's just has a lot of balls. You,
yeah,
know what I mean? It's like, wow. And it's extremely well done. And the imagery, of course, we have the music and the bashing of the skull with the bone and,
yeah,
the famous match cut, you know, jumps 4 million years,
yeah,
from, you know, the man's first tool to his last, you know, amazing stuff. Stuff.
Yeah,
you,
yeah, yeah.
But I do have to say that the Jupiter mission in the center with Hal,
mm-hmm,
is probably my favorite.
Okay.
I think Hal is the most charismatic villain in cinema.
Yeah.
Even though he's a red dot.
Yeah.
And I think the implications of that sequence, and then the thematics of that sequence, when Dave turns Hal off,
mm-hmm,
is my favorite scene in the film.
Nice.
Yeah, when he gets back through the emergency airlock and then goes and turns him off. And Hal's essentially pleading with him to not turn him off. He wants to survive.
Yeah.
And that's such a, again, a simple, like deceptively simple idea.
Yeah.
Because you really realize that man's technology has reached a point where it's become sentient. It's trying to survive, just,
sure,
how we would.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
just like
so,
human.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of disturbing implications in the scene, and then it's so masterfully done. The,
yeah,
red light and the singing of Daisy as his voice slows.
Yeah.
There's just no more thematic part for me anyway. It's a great
very,
film. A great
very
part.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, no, I'd have to say the opening for myself. But
favorite,
Yeah, but we will be talking about Hal a lot through this episode,
mm-hmm,
I'm sure.
Sure.
Yeah, him alone has influenced a million movies.
Yeah, and
you know?
It's funny, he's in it fairly briefly.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, he's really not in it much. He's the kind of the Hannibal Lecter is in Silence of the Lambs for 16 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is always blows
it's
everyone's
exactly
mind.
Exactly like that.
Yeah, Hal is in it. I'm not sure of the exact minute count, but relatively briefly.
Sure. Right on. Well, why don't we go ahead and get into some of these movies that were inspired by 2001.
Where do we start?
Yeah, right? Well, you know what? That's your burden because you're going first. So.
Okay. All right. Well, the thing is that, you know, I had a list about 9 miles long and I thought, well, there's no way to listen to all this. So I tried to narrow it down. Mainly, there's a couple other things, but I'm going to kind of pop into the sci-fi realm. I want to kind of stick there because that's the most literal influence.
Sure.
But because it gets extremely abstract and random, like a Super Bowl commercial could be mentioned, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, what's funny, though, is something that seems like a polar opposite cannot really deny its influence, and that's just going to be the Star Wars franchise.
Sure.
Not only is it takes place in space, of course, that's kind of irrelevant, but it's just the imagery.
Yeah.
The set and the model building is extremely similar. And I think that 2001 set the bar that we still adhere to today of what it looks like to be in space with a cruiser of any kind of ship.
Yeah.
Ships are always reminiscent of the 2001 ships, Discovery in particular, despite them, I don't think, being as creative. I think the 2001 ship Discovery is a really unique ship visually. Mm-hmm. And we got really close to mimicking it, but I don't think anyone's ever made something as unique.
Yeah. I had Star Wars down as well on my list. Yeah, because specifically the ships, specifically all of that space imagery. I mean, to this day, that is how we're designing our spaceships and everything.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild, the foresight to come up with something that, I mean, even in real-life spaceships, a lot of them look fairly similar. I mean, obviously, we don't have space stations to that, you know, level
extent,
or anything,
sure,
but
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they're even in real life, there's a lot of design choices that seem to be culled from that.
Well, that's what's really interesting is Stanley's goal really was to make the proverbial good sci-fi film. That's how he opened up his negotiation with Arthur C. Clarke. He's like, I want to make the best one that ever existed, and that will always be the best.
Yeah.
And I think amazingly he did that. I don't know
right.
how he pulled it off, but. Their biggest concern was plausibility mm-hmm. and reality. There's some, you know, this fantastical story somehow had to be rooted in such detail. And that's something I can go on about infinitely because the kind of research that Stanley did was crazy. A small tidbit is that he actually reached out to numerous companies that existed in the mid to late 60s and said, you know, drop what your product would be like in 2001. And like, we'll incorporate it subtly into the film. And you can see, you know, Howard Johnson is in the film, IBM is in the film, blah, 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 blah. Pretty fascinating. But plausibility is huge. And I think that's why it's now become the standard is because it works. We understand like the framework that 2001 gave us was so plausible and so realistic that to stray too far from that after the fact, I think would be too unbelievable.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it especially with getting companies on board with helping to design things, because then you're talking about the imagination of the companies that really are building things in our real world. And corporations aren't always the most imaginative.
I personally went through the documents of the different companies that wrote back to him.
Yeah.
And some were extremely conservative and ended up being very interesting and thoughtful, and some were just ridiculous. Some were absolutely insane.
Yeah.
And then so much of that really wasn't even incorporated in the film because the film was whittled down over a period of time to kind of become the simplistic, you know, classic masterpiece it is now.
Sure.
But it was much more complicated and convoluted and things like that. And so a lot of that information has been left on the wayside, but some of it's kind of snuck in there. And it's forever, for me, stapled the reality, you know, it stapled the movie to a real place for us to launch from. So it's kind of cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, with my first puzzle piece, I'm going to go with something pretty recent, and that is Christopher Nolan's Interstellar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Murph.
Yeah.
Murph.
Murph. Yeah, no, Murph definitely came from a place of this kind of a mindset, I think. Interstellar, it looks at outer space with a kind of an optimistic view of that there is answers out there, and there is you know, things connecting us all and all that kind of
stuff.
Too
many answers, in my opinion.
Yeah, a little bit.
I didn't like that film particularly very much.
I wasn't the biggest fan of Interstellar either, and I think we're two of the few who.
Yeah, people think that it's brilliant, and it's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's very simple.
Yeah.
I mean, and when I say simple, it's a nice way of saying stupid.
Yeah.
It's stunning. I mean,
yeah.
The thing is, Christopher Nolan is a genius, but he just can't make a good movie anymore, which breaks my heart.
I kind of agree with you, man.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it really does. Like, I was a big supporter. Of course, I loved his films all the way up to 2008, Dark Knight. And that was, I think he peaked, man. And that was been a slow decline.
Yeah.
But the thing is, 2001 is Chris Nolan's favorite film.
Yeah.
You know, he recently just did a 70 millimeter kind of clean up a projection.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. He was the one that set that in motion. Huh?
Yeah, which I approve much more than of Steven Soderbergh's like quick edit. He cut out 45 minutes, and I was like, leave that movie alone, Steve. Make Ocean 70 or whatever. I just stop cutting that movie. But yeah, so yeah, Interstellar is a great puzzle piece because it's definitely like a spiritual.
It is.
Companion.
Yeah, and I like how it also another thing it deals with is the difficulty of dealing with outer space, basically, and the heroism and all that, and which Dave has to be a hero there towards the end of the film, but it's not heroic in the sense of battling space aliens or something like that, right. It's more of like just the general difficulty of being in outer space and dealing with outer space,
Yeah, it's true. I mean, another thing that Interstellar has is a certain plausibility because
right.
I think there is a because he's such a brilliant craftsman, Christopher Nolan, even I don't think if he delivers in certain areas or whatever, I'm just being picky, in reality, he's an extremely talented man, and his films are always very well made and well crafted. So I think a lot of that is that movie's strength, that it's so well crafted, and there's almost a kinship to its plausibility, or it's kind of rooted in real life, plausible things.
Just needed less water planets, I
think. Yeah, need less Matt Damon. No, but it's just it's kind of like where 2001 succeeded in being not emotionally redundant or emotionally oversaturated and not sentimentalist.
Yeah,
I think that really the part that was blown on Interstellar was its sentimentality.
Yeah,
and they try to whittle this is a big problem of all movies in general, is they have these really big ambitious ideas, which I'm always for. Bigger the better.
Yeah,
but then they try to connect the individual audience member by giving us like some throwaway connection.
Yeah,
it's like love of the daughter is what binds the universe. Yeah. I'm like, whatever. Okay,
yeah. Sometimes it's just not necessary.
I don't care. I have no interest. It's not, I don't care. These are such huge ideas that must we scale them down to like this interpersonal thing?
Yeah.
It's like 2001 had the courage to really make it about its idea more than about its characters, and its characters serviced its greater idea.
It is much more about the ideas. Oh, that's one of the things. It's the ideas and just really spectacle in a lot of ways. Such a spectacle film,
without a doubt.
Which is why seeing it IMAX is such a lucky thing. I'm just so happy you got a chance to,
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I was pushing everyone I knew to go. I got actually a couple people that I bugged so much that they actually went, and they did not regret it. So that's always nice.
Nice.
And that's the thing is, it's a hard film to watch on your cell phone. You shouldn't. It's a whole atmosphere that you should really try to give yourself over to.
Yeah.
And then I always try to put myself in an audience of 1968. Like, it's a little slow at parts, but this was the first time they saw space the way at that scale and that with that legitimacy, with that craftsmanship. And I mean, it was mind melting. It's mind melting today, let alone an audience of 1968.
Yeah. Speaking of watching on your cell phone, a movie that might have been a puzzle piece, although I haven't seen it yet, is First Man.
Oh.
And that movie, when I saw the trailer on my phone, I was like, I don't know. I'm kind of interested, But saw it in IMAX. Mm-hmm. Holy shit.
That trailer moved me.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I don't know if I'm biased because I'm kind of interested in space. I'm not like a sci-fi nut. I think I like Star Trek The Next Generation and 2001 and Solaris. And that's kind of where I get out of it. I'm so fascinated by the reality of space travel and like how insane it was that we did it, that we just like got on a little tin can and went to the moon. And that, to me, the space travel represents what the human species can do and be.
Sure.
And the sad part is that we usually fall short of that the majority of the time,
Yeah.
But that's what we're capable of. And that's truly amazing to me. So the First Man trailer blew my mind. And it really drove home the insanity was that we had to start from scratch and we just somehow made it work.
It's nuts.
Yeah. That will be a puzzle piece. It's a future puzzle piece.
Yes, absolutely. When we do the next, when the IMAX 3D version comes out, we'll come back and do this again.
Exactly.
So what would your next puzzle piece be? Yeah.
So I'll do one that's a little less obvious because Star Wars was a little obvious. I'm going to go with a Duncan Jones film called Moon.
That was gonna be my next
one. Oh, I'm killing. I'm sorry.
killing me. No, that's awesome.
Wait, well, I have 90.
Yeah, that's fine.
Why don't you have
moon? No. That's fine. Go ahead.
All right.
We'll both talk about it.
All right, let's just talk about. Okay, we're sharing a puzzle piece here.
Yes.
All right. So, Duncan Jones, obviously David Bowie's son, who David Bowie was also crazy influenced by 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Oh, sure.
His breakout hit being Space Oddity.
Yeah.
Not an accident there.
Oh yeah.
Moon, I think, very cleverly avoids the pitfalls of a movie that basically can't avoid its influence. You know, you smell 2001 on it.
Yes.
And yet I really do think it very cleverly transcends it. It doesn't pander to it. It makes its own film with its own voice. You have like the classical music against the sky, the juxtaposition of this ancient, not ancient necessarily, but kind of this classical music to something so futuristic, which is just a beautiful combination. You know, was something that was so successful in 2001. The waltz compared to these gigantic spaceships floating through space was a stroke of genius. So to kind of like reference that subtly in Moon, pardon me, and then also to have, of course, Gertie, voiced by Kevin Spacey, he who we shall not name, but to great effect, and went against the cliche of it being an evil computer and was actually a very beautiful and helpful computer.
Yeah.
So I think it took kind of those obvious things, like I said, you can't avoid. And it really reinvented it, and it made it a star. It made it a Sam Rockwell movie.
Oh yeah,
because 2001 isn't about Keir Dulay. It's not about Dave Bowman. You know, it's not even about Hal. But this film's about Sam Rockwell.
Oh yeah,
and Moon did a great job, and Sam Rockwell did a stunning performance.
Oh yeah, one of my favorite things he's ever done, and I mean one of my favorite actors. So yeah. I mean, that's quite saying a lot. But yeah, Moon, amazing movie. Another movie that also. Looks from, what did that come out, about 2008-ish?
I think around, I think ballpark, yeah.
So from 2008 looking forward, it looks very much realistic of what the future is going to be, in the same way that 2001 was looking forward as to what the future was going to be.
Yeah, certainly, absolutely, you know? Yeah.
Duncan Jones's his imagination on that really, really shined through. Not so much on his most recent movie, but
I liked Source Code, which
Code was really good.
I liked it.
Yeah.
Everyone hated it, and I was Source still Code. With him.
Yeah,
and then now no good.
Yeah,
I don't know what's happening, man. Didn't he make Warcraft?
Oh yeah, he did World of Warcraft which I did not see.
No.
I know a couple of people actually did like it, but I mean, generally speaking, it got pretty torn apart.
Yeah, I mean, you can't listen to critics every time.
Yeah, true.
People, I mean,
critics didn't like 2001, right?
I was gonna say that was gonna be a nice little tie in there.
Yeah,
I think I mentioned to you before we started recording, 241 people walked out of the New York premiere of 2001: A Space Odyssey, and one of those people was the actor Rock Hudson, who said, "Can someone explain what the hell this movie is about?" And before storming out.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's true. And so the film was very lukewarm. It actually was called Unimaginative. Which is hilarious to me. That's the thing is these are concepts that still boggle the mind.
Yeah.
And it's because it's the eternal, it's about the eternal questions of our existence. That's why it's timeless.
Yeah.
Not only is it on a technical level something that holds up, you know, it's not cheesy or outdated.
Yeah.
Which they really were striving to achieve. And that's why we get the black monolith. It's like, you know, at first, I don't know if you know this, but at first Hal was supposed to be a little robot that moved around the ship, and they're like, "Well, that's going to be outdated next week."
Yeah, yeah.
And then the alien is another thing that they had really trouble. You know, they didn't want to show this alien race, so the monolith represented one of their tools, just how the bone represented one of our tools, or how was the most sophisticated tool. There's like a big theme there.
Yeah.
And the monolith was so simple, and because it needed to be timeless.
Yeah.
And that's where we got a black rectangle, essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just all out of the desire to make this thing last, and people were not ready for it, and it was definitely mixed when it came out. Now, really, now only in the last maybe 20 years has it, you know, now ranks every top best films of all time list.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a good transition to my next puzzle piece then, about the monolith being the black rectangle. This one isn't a movie, but it's smartphones.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the design of smartphones, which, let's be real here, these things are basically changing the course of human existence.
Without a doubt.
I mean, you know, and that's basically what the monolith did, and it looks quite a lot like a smartphone, you know?
Yeah, and guess what? 2001 also invented iPads and Skype.
Yep, absolutely.
So, there's actually an iPhone commercial that is like a send up of 2001. It has the phone floating and people, yeah. You know, monk. I think it's even like,
I think I remember that. Yeah.
Dun, 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 dun. It's like all, you know, so I mean, verbatim off the opening of the film. So yeah, no, without a doubt, we're molded by that monolith.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. This is the monolith. And you know, it's funny. I was, I wanted to make a meme. Maybe someone else will do it because I don't have time right now. But right now, the trend in smartphones, freaking Apple started it with the iPhone X, and now Google's copying it with their new Android phone, is to have a notch cut out for the camera, which kills that monolith-like design. And I'm like, I want to make a Photoshop thing of the monolith with a notch at the top cut out and see if it has the same impact. No, it will not.
It will not.
It's supposed to be a freaking rectangle.
Yeah, man. There's something really it's perfection is really what makes it iconic.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, I mean, to have a divot cut out of it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I mean, just, you know, about the monolith itself, that choice always kind of reminds me of the ending of Sopranos. Because it just cuts to black.
Right, right.
And the thing about 2001 in general, and also about the monolith in particular, just like the ending of Sopranos, it's too specific and too iconic to ever be actually duplicated. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone like mimics 2001, but they could never really rip it off because it just would be too obvious.
Yeah.
Because it's so singular. Like, well, it's one of the brilliant things about the ending of the Sopranos, which is a whole other episode for another time and another place.
Sure.
But, you know, you just... Because nothing's there, you are left to infinite possibilities.
Yes.
And the monolith represents infinite possibility. What is it exactly? What, you know, what does it do exactly? We get a sense of those things. But from a design standpoint, from a conceptual standpoint, and then practically in the film, you know, it's possibilities are endless.
Yes, unknowable.
Yeah. And it makes the cell phone have a brilliant connection because these phones are so powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what's your next puzzle piece then?
Oh, man. Okay. Let's do something a little crazier here.
Oh, okay.
I'm gonna probably go with this is kind of a weird one. So I pulled, but the canon work of the Coen brothers.
Okay.
The Coens are huge Stanley fans and admirers. A puzzle piece in particular I'm gonna use is going to be Burn After Reading.
Okay.
And you guys are like, what? Now, this is only for the super nerds out there, but there's actually a sound effect taken directly from 2001: A Space Odyssey. That is used in the opening and closing of Burn After Reading, and it's a direct reference to that, to 2001 and Stanley. They actually design things, shots, they take sound effects from Stanley's films, and they incorporate them in most of their films. So Burn After Reading actually takes a sound effect of a pod door opening and puts it inside their film.
Nice.
So there you go.
Where's that at?
That's in like the opening credits, like when there's like the Google Map type vibe.
Yeah.
There's a sound effect that's from 2001.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that's also I think another way to look at that particular puzzle piece is Coen Brothers movies. A lot of the times, the overall meanings of things are very much open ended.
Yeah.
Which is something that, you know, I'm not sure if that was something that was happening before 2001 with a lot of movies. Probably, I'm guessing, but still
rare.
I would imagine rare, and that's something that a lot of. You know, these kind of auteur filmmakers do a lot of the times nowadays, and it kind of is a division between people who like more just, you know, mainstream movies and people who like stuff like that.
Yeah.
Where they're open to not being given all the answers, you know?
Yeah, and that's the thing is, 2001 is such a unique kind of example because it's so out there and it really takes you, like, I've seen the movie like probably 50 times, you know. Uh-huh. I've seen it a lot.
Yeah.
And I kind of forget, I take it for granted, like, how risky it was and how brazen and artistic.
Oh, sure.
And it's an art film essentially, and you know, that kind of has a bad connotation to it. An art film, people kind of, you know, turn their nose up to it, but it's considered an American classic.
Sure.
And we're still celebrating it. So I don't know if the strange ideas are really the thing that turns people off. I don't know if it's the approach to certain things or how things are done. But I think 2001 is just so awe-inspiring that it really just gets most everybody can appreciate something about it.
Sure.
And yeah, no, I think the Coens definitely took something away from the open-endedness of 2001.
Yeah.
And I know you're going to laugh at me, but I mean, they're heavily influenced by The Shining.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, Barton Fink is essentially The Shining.
Yeah.
And what's funny is I could actually see the seeds of The Shining in 2001. Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of parallels between that film and his later film, The Shining, that he took elements that he developed and maybe beta tested in 2001 and then honed them for the horror genre with The Shining.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Sure. Well, I'm going to, because as you know, I love the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take it to the exact opposite, to a movie I did not like,
okay.
But I do think was very much inspired by. And that is Mission to Mars. You remember that?
Yeah,
one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Terrible movie. But, you know, finding the structure on Mars versus finding the structure on the moon sets off the, you know, the plot of the rest of 2001 once we get to that point.
Sure.
Which was what set things off. And I think just finding that structure on another planet or,
right.
you know, the moon, but is
huge,
you know,
huge influence. Yeah. Directly, basically directly from that idea.
Yeah.
The same launching pad, which is not nearly as artful.
Yeah. to say the least.
And that's really funny because, I mean, 2001 was actually inspired by a short film or a short, pardon me, a short story of Arthur C. Clarke's called The Sentinel.
Mm-hmm.
And, but to say that it's, I think Arthur C. Clarke brilliantly said that it's like comparing an acorn to an oak tree. You know, they're radically different things by the time it happened. But the only real, you know, the inciting incident, basically, the first incident that launched 2001 was from The Sentinel, which is they find a structure of alien and tantric creation on the moon.
That's right. Yeah, I did actually read that when I was reading about this movie, about how it's really just a little seed of, what it was based on.
Yeah.
The rest of it was something new.
Yeah, because Stanley and Arthur C. Clarke wrote the screenplay and novel simultaneously, which is this is the kind of a rare thing in Stanley's career.
That would have been an interesting room to be in. And...
Well, they wrote it. They were actually in different places. They would actually send memos back and forth to each other. Yeah, it was really interesting. But yeah, Stanley would write parts of the script and send it over for approval, and he'd write parts of the novel and send it back to Stanley, and they'd actually come up with the story that way.
Yeah,
which is super rare for Stanley because that's the only film he didn't base something on like on a pre-established book.
Sure.
So it's probably like one of the most original Stanley films that has no basis in anything else. It's probably 2001. That thing, finding something on the moon, was the basis for all of it.
Yeah.
And then Mission to Mars, I think, saw the brilliance in that and tried to do it again.
Yeah. Let's answer all the questions.
Right. Yeah. Any questions? Not after you watch this movie, man.
Oh, man. So what's your next puzzle piece?
So this is kind of a cool one. I'm going to go back to sci-fi in a second. I'm going to do one that's not quite sci-fi. It's going to be Terry Malick's The Tree of Life.
Okay.
Have you seen that one?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm a big Terry Malick fan, even though he's like now in a stage of self-parody, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't care. I'll watch him float a camera around Austin, Texas until I die. Like, I don't particularly care that he doesn't make coherent movies anymore. And Tree of Life has these bizarre kind of space sequences and to classical music, to Mozart, to opera and things of that nature. And it's basically showing in my opinion anyway, this is speculation, but that the individual life doesn't necessarily matter, but is part of a larger fabric that goes into the infinite, goes into space.
Sure, sure.
And I think that theme is somehow connected within the 2001, maybe a little bit more. Kind of like where I think Interstellar failed. Mm-hmm. I think that Tree of Life was abstract and artful enough to pull it off.
Right.
I mean, I think Interstellar tried to fit too much into kind of a conventional sci-fi blockbuster bottle, and that those are not good ingredients together. But Tree of Life is a very artful, open-ended type film, and so I think it taking something and making it more emotional than it was in 2001 was done well because of its approach and its style. And then, of course, you have just the space imagery, which is hauntingly similar and but equally beautiful to the 2001 imagery.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful imagery for sure. That kind of makes me think of there's a lot of movies, and I'm kind of drawing a blank right now. I didn't write any of these down, but off the top of my head, just movies that do have that kind of crazy imagery. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm telling you, like, it's real. This is a hard movie to talk about because it's almost in everything.
Yeah,
I mean, there's imagery in some way, shape, or form that has been inspired by this movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what's cool.
Okay, well, my next puzzle piece then is another movie. Actually, this is one that I wrote down that's inspired by imagery, and that is Contact.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the wormhole sequence.
Oh,
which is one of the coolest things I think I had ever seen at that point. And it's there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely there in 2001.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing is, Contact's a great movie. You know, Bob Zemeckis' film. I really like it. And it's not the most popular, I guess, because it's a little long and slow for some people.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that's like good sci-fi. You know, sci-fi should be about ideas, I think, not about the tangibles so much, you know?
Yeah.
2001, of course, struck great balance in that regard. But Contact's excellent. And yeah, the Stargate or the wormhole sequence is, I think, extremely similar.
Yeah, to a degree also with Contact. I forget, I haven't seen it in a long time, but the thing that they had to make or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that kind of reminds me of the tools and whatnot, you know?
Yeah.
The alien technology and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was, like, one of my favorite parts about Contact is, like, that they have all this footage of, like, like VHS tape footage that's hours and hours and hours long, but she only fell through for, like, 5 seconds. Like,
yeah.
There was a little couple twists in there I thought were really excellent.
That was really cool.
And, again, that film, again, it kind of, I don't think anyone's had the courage yet to approach a film almost as academically as 2001 did, because
sure.
Again, we're, you know, she's going to find her father, and there's like this whittling down to this emotional level of like this person loves this other person, and they have to go through the galaxy to get them.
It's probably Spielberg's fault, huh?
It's definitely Spielberg's fault. Yeah, it's his fault for everything.
Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, I feel like space and these ideas are they're big enough to maybe make more movies about them as opposed to the characters within them.
Sure.
And that's a doubt. I think I'm not saying that people don't think these big thoughts, these other filmmakers, but I think it's just so scary to make a movie without that kind of emotional core today.
Yeah.
It's too risky for them to even try. So it's very similar, but again, polar opposite type approach.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
What's your next puzzle piece?
So I'm going to have to go with the Russian masterpiece Solaris, made by Andrei Tarkovsky. He's one of my filmmaker favorites, and I think one of the few people that it's appropriate to call like a master. Like there's like a handful of masters out there, Stanley being one of them. Tarkovsky, he made this wonderful sci-fi film that is very, very philosophical. Just very briefly, it's about a guy who goes on a space station and he orbits a planet, and the planet projects the crew member's deepest desires into them.
Right.
And he starts seeing his wife, his deceased wife, roaming around the ship. And it was kind of a strange...
Are you sure you're not talking about Event Horizon?
I am. Yeah. Yes. Sam Neill. You know what's funny? The imagery of hell from Event Horizon is terrifying.
It is. It's the scariest thing that's ever happened in the universe.
That movie makes no sense at all.
No.
I love
it's so scary.
It's pretty good there. Yeah, I love Event Horizon. So I'm really not sure if I'm not describing Event Horizon. But no, but Solaris, I think... The thing about 2001 is it legitimized sci-fi.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It legitimized it. It said, hey, this on the world stage, you can make sci-fi art. This is something, there's like so much infinite possibility here to comment about things that are earthly, things about the humanity. We can go out to the distant stars and make a comment about those things. So I think that grabbed the attention of other prominent filmmakers. And you had someone like Tarkovsky, who, like I said, was another master. He ended up making a lot of sci-fi films. He did Solaris. He did Stalker. He did, what is it called? The last one, he did The Sacrifice, and that's going to be kind of a futuristic film, but Nuclear Holocaust. So he ended up doing, like, actually experimenting quite a bit in sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
But Solaris really owes a debt of gratitude to 2001, because it I think picked up on the philosophical elements that were kind of where 2001 left off.
Right.
And the potential that 2001 said, hey, you have all this room to play. So another master kind of picked up the ball and made something very unique, very specific to him and very beautiful and kind of iconic in its own right, but not quite as accessible.
Mm-hmm.
2000, despite all of what we're talking about, 2001, it's still accessible.
Right.
You can go see it at an IMAX theater. And that was kind of the ingenious aspect of Stanley. How did he make an ultimate, bizarre, crazy sci-fi action art film, and that we still go watch it and almost all audiences can enjoy it?
Sure.
That's crazy to me. So Solaris is a little bit more exclusive, maybe a little bit more of the art crowd or the foreign film crowd, but definitely thought-provoking and brilliant.
I actually got to admit, I haven't seen Solaris.
It's so good.
Yeah. One of these days.
Don't watch the George Clooney remake.
Right.
Yeah.
Add that to my Netflix queue.
For all you listeners out there, if you type in Solaris based on my recommendation and George Clooney pops up, that's the wrong movie.
It's probably a good thing you just mentioned that.
Don't watch that one.
Yeah.
Or his shorter 2001 version. Don't do that.
Nice. All right. Well, my next puzzle piece is, I'm going to bring it back to Hal again here.
Okay.
Well, I guess, in some ways to really just the whole film, but, the Alien series, and specifically Alien Covenant,
yeah.
as where it has gone.
Yeah.
Do you like Alien Covenant?
No.
Okay. I loved Alien Covenant. I recognize that it has all the same problems as Prometheus,
which is
a stupid crew and just a pure ridiculousness. Yeah. But I love David's story. I absolutely love it. Yeah. And I think in a lot of ways that this is a kind of a next step for a Hal-like character, you know, of the creation of humans that, you know, is turning on their creator and whatnot. I think that character is so great. I really hope that series that he gets to do another one. I know Ridley Scott wants to.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't, especially with the mergers and all that stuff. I have a feeling it's not going to happen.
It's going to get shelved.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
But I mean, the character is so, so interesting, I think.
Yeah. Hal in the Michael Fassbender body ain't so bad.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Say what you will about Hal, he's not very attractive. Michael Fassbender, on the other hand.
There you go.
I'll watch him do anything.
It's true.
No.
Absolutely.
But, I agree. I mean, the thing is, like, Hal has so much potential, mm-hmm. and that I think he should be explored in other avenues in some way, shape, or form. And I think David is a great example of that. I do think he's a great character. I was super intrigued by him during Prometheus.
Yeah.
Which is a bad, bad movie.
Yeah, Prometheus not... See, I feel like Covenant made Prometheus a little better, but it's still not
that's
a very
fair.
Good movie.
That's fair. Yeah, I was going to say, that's playing fast and loose.
Yeah.
Like, but the thing is, when we rag on these movies, I hope people know that, like, these are not bad films. Like, you know how hard it is to make these movies? Like, they're brilliant and they're, you know, craftsman-wise are insane.
Yeah.
So there's so much good in them. But, like, as for me anyway, the reason why I'm a harsh critic on certain films is, like, when movies are that good, they should be great.
Yes.
They should be smart. They should say something or be meaningful in some way or even really not so incoherently insane. Like, something, like you said, Prometheus had all kinds of stupid plot holes and stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, when things are that good, I expect a lot more.
Right.
When things are bad, I don't care.
Well, I think that makes the difference between just a casual moviegoer and a real film fan.
Yeah.
Someone who expects a lot from the movies they watch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And yeah, we're not just shitting on movies just to shit on them. You
no,
know?
No.
It's like in most movies, I do find, I mean, there's some that I just can't see anything in it that I like, but but most movies, at least there's a good performance, there's a good idea, it's well shot or something. There's usually something, you know, keeping it, making it worthwhile.
Sure.
Know?
And the thing is, on these big budget movies, these crews are the best in the business.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, the thing about Ridley Scott is, like, that guy can make a movie.
Oh yeah.
My problem lies in when he walks to the Colosseum and says, it's not big enough.
Yeah.
That's like, it's like a philosophical problem. Like, I love movies so much that, like, again, like Chris Nolan, like, I acknowledge that guy is a genius, but and because he's so good, I want better movies.
Mm-hmm.
Be better.
Yeah.
Like, you're not Michael Bay. I don't care what Michael Bay makes. He can make Ninja Turtles 7. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't bother me any. It doesn't have to be good. Just make it.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, when I watch Dunkirk or something, or I watch, you know, another film of his, like, I want as good as I know he can be.
Yes.
So yeah, I don't mean to crap on movies. I love movies.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So, but yeah, Prometheus was I was so excited for Prometheus, not to get off on a tangent, but the trailer was impeccable.
Yeah.
Like,
it
the
really
trailer
was
so good that I was actually excited.
I would also
excited.
Argue that the first 15 minutes were so good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It basically just turned into a fist fight, though. That was the biggest problem. It was like, wow, you created us. Boom. and I was like, oh, God. I was so heartbroken. But yeah, no. I mean, 2001, especially in the sci-fi genre, just lives in these things. I mean, I even say the first Alien.
Yeah,
the very first Alien, it's definitely a adrenaline infused version, and this went on to influence James Cameron, who did Aliens, and then went on to do other, you know, Terminators and things. I mean, 2001 lives in all this.
Yes,
and a big part of why is because these filmmakers were impressionable, were young when they saw 2001,
sure.
and it literally blew their minds. And has just kind of been on their work ever since. I feel like the fingerprints of Stanley Kubrick live on most of these modern directors' films.
Oh, for sure.
We can, you know, if we took a black light to them, they'd pop up everywhere. And I don't know if it's conscious or subconscious, but I think most of it's subconscious. I think that it just like me, my influences bleed into my work. I try to purposefully ignore them so I don't mimic them. I try to find my own voice. But the reality of it is I'm a culmination of those people that came before me and,
sure.
and you know, made up my influence. So that's definitely the case going on there. It was very subtle ways that 2001 influences things.
Yeah.
But then there's also the overt, like, reference and nod. And those guys aren't afraid to do that either. Sure. So yeah, the Alien series for sure is very Kubrickian.
Yeah, definitely.
Kind of, I think, in its terror element. And its inhuman element. Stanley was sometimes called inhuman, or things like that, which I disagree with completely. Just watch the end of Paths of Glory and tell me it's not human.
Right.
But there is that calculating academic quality, and I think Alien kind of carries that with it.
Sure. So, what's your next puzzle piece?
All right, so the next one is going to be... I have so many to choose from. Who even knows anymore? I'm going to kind of maybe just do another interesting, kind of a weird one. But the Midnight Movie Circuit, which I'll include Eraserhead, and I will include El Topo in that. So El Topo was the first big Midnight Movie film. It's a Mexican film, and it's kind of an acid Western. And it sounds very strange, but it's very religious in tone. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's a secular quality to 2001, but it also has kind of a spiritual. I think people can find spiritual things in it.
Oh, yeah,
if they want. And I think that El Topo kind of took that to kind of 0 to 60, to cranked up the volume a bit, and made a film. I had the courage to make basically an avant-garde art film out of a normally limited genre. Mm-hmm. You know, it was an acid Western. Westerns were so indelibly a part of the American landscape, the American cinematic landscape. And just like sci-fi was kind of ridiculed in its own little thing, its little subgenre.
Sure.
El Topo was like, well, no, there's art in this, and there's imagery, and there's ideas here. And I think that that out of the Western genre, I think that El Topo is the 2001 of the Western genre. And it was made in 1971. And the filmmaker has acknowledged a direct influence from Stanley's work, of course. So I definitely think it lives there, but it definitely finds its own voice. And then what's really cool about Eraserhead, small story here, is that it was made by David Lynch. It was David Lynch's first feature film, took several years to make, came out in the late 70s. Heavily influenced by the atmosphere of the middle section of 2001 A Space Odyssey with HAL.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely way more avant-garde and more horror in its approach. But that actually ended up going on to become one of Stanley's favorite movies.
Yeah.
And he would invite people over to his theater, like a personal theater, to show them Eraserhead. And that got back to David Lynch, who, of course, just gushed and melted into a pile of tears.
Yeah.
Because that's such an amazing thing. And then when Stanley went on to make The Shining, he actually showed his crew and cast Eraserhead.
Wow.
And said, like, this is what we're going for. So they kind of, it's like a snake swallowing its own tail. They kind of went back on each other. But yeah, the Midnight Movie era, I think, was, in general, not just those two films, but all of it, it was a huge thank you to 2001. Because, as we mentioned earlier, the hippie movement and the drug culture made 2001 the major financial success that it ended up being. Because it was kind of sketchy if it was going to make its money. Because it was kind of, it was a $10.5 million movie, which was crazy in 1968.
Sure.
Anyway, so, but the midnight movie craze then became a cultural movement. People went and saw movies at midnight. They waited around the block to watch Pink Flamingos, and they waited to watch Eraserhead. And there was a kind of a cultural movement of the 70s that I think just in general is because the culture responded to 2001.
It's interesting because, so you're basically like, you're getting at the... like weird artful movies becoming a thing that people are seeking out and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas at the same time, it's also kind of like a blockbuster, you know, it
gave birth
to blockbusters, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. It kind of really splits out in both ways. I mean,
That's the thing is, you know, Stanley was friends with Steven Spielberg, but his favorite movie was Eraserhead.
Right.
So I think that sums it up.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite stories is, Steven Spielberg would send Stanley copies of his movies to get like approved. Like he'd get Stanley's opinion before he ever gave it to any, you know, company.
Yeah.
And then he asked him, he said, Stanley, you know, you're working on Full Metal Jacket. Will you send me an early version of it? And then he said, no. And he goes, well, I send you mine. And he goes, well, that's the difference between me and you.
God.
So yeah, so I mean, Stanley definitely admired Spielberg. Yeah, oh yeah, burn, man, burn. No, Stanley definitely admired Steven Spielberg, and who shouldn't? I mean, everyone should, you know, admire him to an extent. But I think the kind of filmmaker Stanley wanted to be was a David Lynch status.
Yeah.
He just somehow figured out to reach a broader audience. He somehow was able to balance an art film and a blockbuster simultaneously, and that's gonna make he's kind of alone in that.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's really cool.
Yeah,
I like that one. Right on. Well, my next puzzle piece is actually a video game. I'm not sure. Are you a gamer?
I am not a gamer.
You're not a gamer.
I
okay.
once played Halo one time. Okay. No, I'm just kidding. I used to play with a friend of mine, but I don't know anything about games at all.
Okay. Well, it's a game called Portal. Have you ever heard of it?
Oh yeah, I played it one. Like I really did play one time. It was really cool when you like hop through different little portals.
Yeah. Portal is a really cool, unique game. And really, the main thing is the main antagonist is GLaDOS, which is a total HAL, copy. But yeah, I mean, it really drives you through the game, and it's constantly like lying to you, and it's kind of like, you know, and you don't realize it from the beginning, but as you're continuing, you're realizing, oh, this thing does not have my best interests.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, and it's really unique and interesting the way that they do it. The game's got some really great writing, compared to most video games, you know. But yeah, GLaDOS is totally born from HAL. Absolutely, 100%.
That's cool. I was going to say, weirdly enough, kind of do an impromptu puzzle piece.
Sure.
Because of Portal and games, and speaking of Halo, Halo. Okay. I don't know if you remember. Did you ever play it?
You know, I never actually did get into the Halo series.
Okay, so it's okay. It's fine.
Yeah.
But like I said, not a big gamer, but it was fun to play. But there's a little blue orb that floats around that has like a HAL-esque voice, a computer-like voice.
Sure.
And it's basically HAL, but blue.
Yeah.
And it's so, yeah, HAL is definitely, he's kind of like a benevolent, you know, he's good and bad. He kind of helps you out, then he kind of betrays you. And then when you have to kill him, he does turn red, actually.
Yeah.
Now that I'm remembering it. So, yeah, he's pretty HAL.
Nice.
Except for, like, in a wall, he's like an orb that flies around.
It makes a lot of sense for video games if they're trying to elevate to another level of storytelling to look at the masters of film.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
You know, you don't go and say, oh, we want to make this better than, you know, story-wise, better than just a video game. Let's look at Michael Bay movies. You know what I mean?
Right,
let's look at the real classics.
Yeah,
stuff,
without a doubt.
Makes so much sense. All right, what's your next regular puzzle piece?
Okay, my next regular one. Well, I'm going to go with kind of a twofer here a little bit.
Okay, cool.
I'm going to do some modern films because it's easy for me to get lost in the old stuff.
Sure.
The new Blade Runner.
Okay.
And the old Blade Runner, actually.
Nice.
But yeah, Blade Runner, the franchise.
Sure.
Again, that's going to be another Ridley Scott. I think he left a huge imprint. 2001 left as an artist. But also Arrival.
Okay, yeah.
And I think these are really atmospheric puzzle pieces. Like Arrival is suspiciously good. Like when I saw it, I was like, why is this so good?
Right.
You know, I was like really kind of. And people were a little bit disappointed in it, and it kind of had like a Chris Nolan twist vibe to it.
It had such a Chris Nolan twist.
Yeah, and I didn't love that about it.
Yeah.
But there's so much good in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's like Arrival's a good film. It's not a great movie. It's not perfect, but man, is it good.
Yeah.
And I think, the kind of the withdrawn performances of Amy Adams, because she's a great actress. I think she emotes beautifully, but she's kind of reserved and closed in. She kind of reminded me of a female Dave Bowman, you know, who internally has every battle. If there's a part in 2001 when HAL won't let him back in, you know, won't let him back into the space station.
Sure.
And he's furious. And there's one part where you can see him just swallow his anger.
Yeah.
He like kind of loses it. You know, his friend just died. HAL's gone insane. He's stuck in the middle of space. And for like only a fleeting moment does he really have an emotional.
He's keeping his cool like the whole time up until that.
Yeah, and he just kind of, and it's not any, he doesn't yell. He just swallows and just has like a minor shake.
Yeah.
That's like as intense as he gets. And then he says, okay, I'll go through the emergency airlock, you know, and it's like, what a great iconic moment that whole thing is.
Sure.
But the Amy Adams performance, number one, I think ties Arrival to it. Again, with I think the same goes for Rygaz. And his kind of muted performance.
Yeah.
As Kay or
I
J?
Think that was his name. Kay. Yeah.
I loved the new Blade Runner, by the way. I don't care at all about the old one.
I didn't love the new Blade
Runner. Really? Well, except Jared Leto.
Yeah.
If you cut Jared Leto out.
You're gonna think I'm really weird here.
Oh, no.
He was my favorite part of it. And I'm not a huge Jared Leto fan.
I despise Jared Leto.
I thought he was so interesting, that character. And, you know, I think part of the reason I like that character is because I walked in that movie so sure they were going to tie it to Alien Covenant. I was like, this is the creator of David. You just wait and watch. Like you know, I was like, this somehow is going to tie into David.
Get
somehow.
That fan fiction going.
Yeah, I wrote a whole fan fiction in my head the whole time. So maybe I wasn't even paying attention to the movie. Maybe the movie was, yeah, my fan fiction. But
yeah,
no.
No, that's hilarious. I'll tell a quick funny story about Jared Leto. So I don't like Jared Leto, as you probably figured out.
Sure.
And I was in Hollywood one time, and I was really drunk, like super drunk. And I was just going off on Jared Leto. And I don't know, who knows? I don't know why. Someone mentioned him. I lost my mind. And I was drunk and kind of trying to be funny. So I was like, I hope he dies. Like, I was like saying really insane stuff, you know?
Yeah.
I don't mean any of it. I don't want him to die. And the guy I'm talking to looks at me and goes, he's my brother. And it was.
God.
It turned out to be his brother. So I was like, I'm sorry, man. That's just a little lesson. You don't know who you're talking to in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Just tread lightly. But I stick by my criticism of his performance in that movie. I think he's the worst part of Blade Runner 2049. But I loved that movie. But yeah, very very Kubrickian.
Yeah.
Definitely. I think atmosphere-wise, tonal, it's slow and paced. 2001's very paced.
Yeah.
And I think, which is to its benefit, in my opinion. And then those, you know, Arrival and 2049 are very elegant, very paced, thoughtful, beautifully shot. I think technical achievements were exceptional. They're more conceptual films than they are plot films.
Yes, yes.
So I think they owe, both a lot to 2001.
I think if I was to go back and watch 2049 looking for that, I would have liked it a lot more.
Yeah.
Because it's beautiful. It's got some really cool ideas. The score, of course, you know. I just was expecting some really interesting story elements, and it didn't quite go anywhere for me.
Well, okay, that's fair. Yeah. You know, that's fair. I will acknowledge that. For some reason, I really worked for me. I was excited to know about the K character, and, you know, I don't care so much about the lore of this franchise. Like, again, I'm not a big fan of the original.
Sure.
So I was like, I don't care if you're the kid or not. I don't care.
Yeah.
I was more interested in just him slowly, I think, realizing his humanity.
Sure.
And that
was good. Yeah, absolutely.
And even that's maybe a more positive view of Hal, who slowly realizes his humanity.
Yeah.
It's funny because Stanley once described like what happened with Hal. He very rarely explained anything. He once quoted Nabokov, the great, you know, Russian author, and said, I meant what I wrote. When people asked Nabokov what he meant, he said, I meant what I wrote. And he said, if I can transition that to my film work, I meant what I showed you. I mean, I meant what I showed.
Sure.
But he actually said that Hal was having basically an emotional crisis because he was facing his own fallibility.
Yeah.
So maybe the K character in 2049 is gradually understanding his humanity, and it's a positive thing. So where I think the more human Hal became, the more insane he became.
Sure.
So that's kind of interesting.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, my next puzzle piece, and this is actually my last puzzle piece.
Okay.
I decided to save this one for last because a lot in the way that you sometimes tend to bring up The Shining a lot, I'm going to bring up my favorite movie of all time again, Adaptation.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe it's more of a simplistic view, but just the fitting all of existence into it,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Which in a lot of ways, you know, 2001, you know, starting from that beginning with the apes and, you know, and, mm-hmm. and as they, you know, learn, and then all of a sudden we're to the future, you know?
Yep.
I love that so much about the opening and then of him trying to just fit everything into this novel, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
And also too, it's about evolution.
Yeah.
And so is 2001.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, 2001, again, this is still debated, so I'm not the authority on this, but I really feel strongly that there's a lot of evidence that this is about our evolution as a species that is pushed forward by our tools. That's, to me, what the film's actually about.
Sure.
And, of course, the sci-fi element is that the monolith is pushing us. You know, maybe that there's an alien influence to our evolution. That's the sci-fi part.
Yeah.
But everything else is almost documentary-like.
Yeah.
That we are evolving because of our tools. Look at our cell phone. Look at the thing that's changing everything.
Yeah.
And even at the end, you know, Dave becomes the star child. He becomes the next step of evolution.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's because our tools, we've outgrown our own tools. Our tools have become so sophisticated that then the, you know, by Hal, and the Hal is now trying to survive and kill us.
Yeah.
So we've reached the pinnacle of what we can create tool wise.
Sure.
So then the monolith must come back in and give us one more push.
Yeah.
And we get the hybrid man baby.
Yeah.
That is so famous at the end. So, yes. I mean, if you look at it that way, it makes a lot more sense, but the roadmap there is crazy. Kind of like adaptation.
Yeah.
It all ties in so beautifully, but it's a wild ride on the way.
Sure is. Yeah.
Yeah. I love adaptation.
Oh yeah.
And yeah. So good.
I actually did think of one more, but it's your turn, so I'll let you go ahead.
No, go ahead. I got a million.
You go next. This way we can spread it out a little
bit. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Okay. My next one is Spaceballs.
Nice.
I'm a big Mel Brooks fan. I think he's hilarious. And Spaceballs, so do you remember the beginning of Spaceballs when it's just the ship?
Yes.
And it's like comically long?
Yeah.
It's the exact same shot and composition as when we first meet the Discovery ship in 2001.
Yeah.
But it's like five times longer.
Yeah.
And it's just making fun of how big that and long that shot is and how slow 2001 is. So yeah, I mean, it's brilliant. It's a brilliant send up of 2001.
That's great. That's great. That's funny too, because I think that I'm trying to remember if on this show we've ever done where there's a parody, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that might be the first time that's come up.
Yeah,
that's hilarious.
But yeah, the opening of Spaceballs always kills me, being such a huge 2001 fan.
Oh yeah,
like no one's laughing, especially like a more contemporary audience that like doesn't know that reference.
Yeah,
and I'm just like cracking up.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm laughing harder the longer the shot goes because it is like so silly. And now I was just in IMAX, a couple days ago, watching the movie, chuckling to myself, trying to stay quiet because there's this 4 minute shot.
So, Mel Brooks is the best.
He's the best, man. Yeah, he's the best.
He's so good.
So good.
Well, yeah, so I got one more puzzle piece, unless I think of another one along the way. But and this one's kind of ridiculous. Okay.
Ridiculous.
When you were talking about the tools pushing us forward and all that stuff, the ancient aliens theory.
No, that's 2001 is the ancient aliens theory.
I know,
it really
exactly.
Is, yeah.
It's that taken as gospel.
Yeah,
you know?
Really.
It really is.
Making a plausible story out of it.
Yeah. Which actually the first season of the show on it was actually really fun to watch. Uh-huh. It just kind of really went up its own ass after that point. But
yeah, how long did you stretch that?
Yeah, I mean, and it kind of gets me dangerously close to conspiracy theory territory, which scares me a little bit. Yeah, but no, ancient alien theory is absolutely, with the monolith going back and pushing humans to evolve, which is aliens coming and helping humans along in their course of history.
Exactly. No, and it's perfect. Exactly. And you said, and I mean, I really do feel that there's a lot of credible evidence that that's what that film's actually about, 2001.
Sure. Makes sense.
It really does. It makes a lot more sense having given it that kind of framework.
Yeah.
And you said a very key word that's going to actually bring up a topic I want to talk about, which I'm not sure if this counts as a puzzle piece. I think it does.
Sure.
So you can be the judge, master and commander of this podcast.
Oh, okay.
You just look so much like Russell Crowe that I just can't. So the conspiracy theorists in the world, and that's too little broad for this, but essentially we talk about how that this film has permeated all culture. And it has, and mainly in a positive way, and mainly in an entertainment way. And on one end of the spectrum, it actually inspired the real, real NASA to play the music as they launched over Earth. And I mean, so 2001's gone everywhere, but also the dark corners of our society.
Oh yeah.
And this movie has ruined people's lives. People have gone. I'm not kidding you.
It's true. I know exactly what you're talking about.
This film, 2001: A Space Odyssey, has put people in crazy houses. They've put them in mental wards. People have dedicated their whole lives to the conspiracy theory that Stanley shot the moon footage, which is the famous one I want to talk about.
Oh,
which
so
of
crazy.
Course is ridiculous.
So crazy.
Leon Vitali. Stanley's close personal assistant for many years. He was a star in one of his films called Barry Lyndon, my personal favorite movie. And he went on to be a friend of his that worked with him closely. And there's a whole film about Leon called Film Worker, which you should check out. But I was talking to Leon actually personally, we're just chatting, and he goes, if Stanley made the moon footage, it would have been better.
Yeah, right?
So I love that joke. Yeah, so this whole conspiracy element, there was actually, I don't know, not to get off too far off topic, but there was these plates. I don't know if you ever heard about this, but instead of subway sewer lids, people would find these plates that had information about 2001 just in the street. and no one knew how they got there. And it was a mystery for several years, like many, I think it was like 15 years, something like that. And no one knew how these plates got there, but they had these random pieces of information about 2001. It turned out a guy was living in his car. He had cut out a hole in the bottom of his car. He'd make these plates, and then while parked over the sewer, he would put them in and then drive off.
Wow.
And they tracked him down, figured it all out, took years to do, and people lost their mind, David. They lost their mind. And so, and then on the other positive end of that spectrum, one of my favorite things is John Lennon lost his mind, essentially saw this film, was so moved by it. He once said that it should play in a temple 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But what, you know, and he was a piece of shit bastard as sure. a human being. He could yeah. write a pop song, but man, was he a piece of shit.
Yeah.
But one of the nice things that he did do is he bought tickets, or he bought the amount of tickets for an entire year, and kept them at the will call, the box office for a theater, so that people who couldn't afford tickets could go and see this movie, because he thought it was so important that That's the awesome. Human race actually sees this film. So
what a cool story.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. So 2001, like, I don't know if that qualifies as a puzzle piece, but it has truly upset the apple cart
yeah.
in positive ways and has really damaged people too.
I'll put it as a addendum to ancient alien theory.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Okay.
Goes right along with it.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't honestly think we grasp the significance of this film.
Yeah.
I don't think we could ever really see how far it's reached.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but like you said, in the rest of the world as well as in cinema, I mean, it's got yeah. so many, it's influential in so many different ways.
Absolutely.
You know what? Why don't you go ahead and do one more and
okay.
then we'll wrap it up.
Sounds good. So, let's see. Do I want to do like a good movie or a funny one? I can't decide. Let's just go with kind of an interesting one. It's called The Simpsons.
Oh, nice.
Now, if you know anything about The Simpsons, if you're a fan of The Simpsons, Kubrick has laid throughout the entire thing. They parody The Shining. Bart dresses up as Alex from A Clockwork Orange. There's multiple references to 2001: A Space Odyssey, even with monkeys and the bone, apes and the bone. So yeah, there's literal influences, but also I even think in Matt Groening's style and his. What in his reach, because Simpsons is maybe the other pop culture phenomenon that we don't understand its influence.
God, we could do a Simpsons episode of this show, and oh my God.
Without a doubt, we could. And so, yeah, I think Kubrick kind of burned himself into the mind of Matt Groening, and I think there's literal ways that he's explored it and shown it and paid tribute, but I think there's just even in the actual approach, there's something about kind of eerily 2001 about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great one. It's funny you say it because I was thinking about The Simpsons at one point. I was thinking about TV shows and movies in general who have just, maybe not as like a full-on influence, but have just, you know, used little bits and pieces
yeah.
as basis for comedy over
mm-hmm.
the years.
Sure.
You know? Yeah, because there's a lot of great parodyable moments, you know, throughout.
Oh, yeah. 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 So Stanley said there's only one deliberate joke, and that's the zero-gravity toilet.
Oh, nice.
Which I always laugh. I always get a good laugh out of it. And it kind of makes me, what's funny about Stanley too, is like the consensus was that he was like this mad genius. And the more you learn about him, really, he was just like a normal guy from Brooklyn.
Sure.
You know, he was a normal guy from Brooklyn. He wasn't the recluse. He just didn't talk to the press. He didn't talk to, you know, he just hung out with his family and his friends. And he was kind of like a real blue collar guy. Like, he had a real wicked sense of humor. He had dirty jokes, kind of a foul mouth sometimes. He didn't have a lot of decorum sometimes. And yet he was supremely, supremely intelligent and just became a master of everything that he ever looked at and studied. So he was the supreme genius, but he was also a real regular guy.
Sure.
And I love that he made a bathroom joke in 2001, perhaps the most highbrow movie of all time. There's like a funny toilet joke in it.
Yeah, right.
And that kind of gives you an idea of that he was just a kind of regular guy like us.
That's humanity.
Exactly. We all poop.
Yeah, exactly.
How would we poop in space? Stanley was curious.
So I'm going to do the finished puzzle now.
Okay.
And run down all of the movies we just discussed here. So let me see here. I got my notes. Got a lot here. Okay. So we've got Interstellar, Coen Brothers movies. Specifically, you mentioned Burn After Reading, The Tree of Life, Solaris, Moon, the Alien series, specifically Alien Covenant, Contact, Mission to Mars, midnight movies like Eraserhead, El Topo, El Topo?
El Topo, yep.
Yeah. Halo, Blade Runner, Portal, Star Wars, Mission to Mars, smartphones. What else we got here? Arrival, Spaceballs, Ancient Alien Theory and Conspiracy Theorists, The Simpsons. I think that was all of them.
That's a heck of a puzzle.
Yeah, big, big list here. Big, yeah. Big list.
And there's a million more.
Yeah, there's a million more. I know you got a bunch more there, you know, but yeah.
No, I won't, no.
Yeah, but no, it's such an influential movie. Mm-hmm. I said to you as soon as I left the theater, I was like, this would make so much sense to, let's do this. Do a Breaking It Apart episode on this. Yeah, such an influential movie and a cool movie. And like I said earlier, I'm so happy I got a chance to see it in IMAX. You know,
I'm so thankful you got to see it too.
Yeah.
I mean, I really, it's funny. Like I said, I've seen it so many times, but I made it an effort to see it a few times in IMAX while it's been playing.
Yeah.
And I took people that hadn't seen it before. I was like, you must see this. So I even got a chance to take a friend of mine who hadn't seen it at all.
Nice.
And, you know, his brains were leaking out of his ears at the end, you know. And that's a great feeling. And this movie has such an impact to a modern audience. There's nothing, you know, old and antiquated about it for the most part. There's, you know, minor little things, but there you can still walk away going, how did they do that? How did they do that? And what is this about? And I feel so, I think you're stupefied by it. You're inspired by it. It's so big in scope and yet so simple. I mean, it's a tightrope walk that I don't know if it will ever really be duplicated.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you're a filmmaker, and you were obviously influenced by Stanley Kubrick in many ways, specifically this movie a lot, would you say?
I would say that, yeah, actually. Really, interesting anecdote about me is that I saw this film when I was 6 years old for the first time, and I wanted to be an actor at that point, which thankfully that, you know, God has taken me off that path. So I wanted to be an actor, and I saw this film, and there's an overture in the beginning of the film. Or just under black. So there's a black screen and classical kind of horrifying music plays, and it puts you in that place, puts you ready for the film. And I thought the VHS tape was broken.
Sure.
To give you an idea of just kind of how young and malleable I was when I first watched this movie. Now, of course, I had no idea what the film was about. I don't know if I do now, let alone
right,
then.
Right.
Let alone then. But the film had such an impression on me and left such just burn marks on my brain from the imagery and from the tension and the mastery of the craft that it really almost single-handedly made me want to become a filmmaker. When the music, which we didn't talk about, the iconic music, which now has been ripped off on every commercial, every video, every movie has that music. So that's another thing we could talk about for all night long.
Sure.
But when that music crescendos
It
says a Stanley Kubrick production, 2001 Space Odyssey, in my little six-year-old brain, I went, I want to do that.
Yeah.
And I really mean, I can almost whittle it down to that moment.
Yeah.
So that's was one thing. And then just recently, I have been very, very fortunate to come back from England, where I actually had access to the Stanley Kubrick archive. And
it's so crazy.
Yes, there's a Stanley Kubrick archive, which I was very lucky, had access to. I was given 5 hours by myself, and they just brought me anything I wanted, which was absolutely insane. I have some kind of insight into this movie that maybe some people don't have. Again, sure. I don't want to say I've solved the puzzle, you know, to use a bad pun.
But well, it makes sense on the show.
Right. But I was actually given the opportunity to go through logistical documents of how this film was practically made, how things were organized and scheduled. I got to hold props and photographs. I actually held the original memos that Stanley would send to Arthur C. Clarke back and forth with handwritten notes and things of that nature. One of the most amazing ones that I actually was able to read. Still kind of, I don't mean to gush like a fanboy, but it's still hard to wrap my mind around.
It's awesome to hear, seriously. Yeah.
There was, when Hal reads the lips of the spaceman, you know, reads Dave and Frank's lips in the pod, when they plan to turn him off, they didn't know how to do that. And Stan, there's kind of a misconception that Gary Lockwood, the actor who played Frank Poole, came up with that idea. But I think that's a little bit of a misnomer, or at least maybe he was part of it somehow. But there was a memo that Stanley sent to Arthur C. Clarke that was like, I think Hal should read their lips in the pod. And if this is successful, that's my favorite part. If this is successful, it'll be very effective. And it's like, yeah, it's the most famous part in cinema history.
Right?
Like, it was pretty effective.
Yeah, I think it worked a little bit.
So that was an amazing experience to be able to be in there and have a special insight into all of his work, but also 2001 specifically.
It must have been a wild experience. I mean, just especially for you, like being so influenced by his work to be able to see that kind of stuff. It's crazy.
It is crazy. And it didn't even stop there. I mean, I thought that was how I can kind of top out on that experience, but it even got crazier.
Oh my
which,
God.
Which I've just kind of been... given a little ability to tell everyone about it, so I'd love to share it with you a little bit.
Awesome.
So I'm making a film right now, which I've talked about on other podcasts with you, but it was kind of, it's a little up in the air. It's early in pre-production, so I don't want to say too much.
Sure.
But I have some pretty exciting news that I'd love to share with you now. So when I was in England, in addition to going to the Stanley Kubrick archive and feeling very fortunate, I was actually invited to Stanley's home. And where he lived, he's passed away now. He's been dead 19 years.
Right.
But I was invited by his widow, the artist Christiane Kubrick. Her and I were in contact. And my film is partially inspired by a real life painting called The Portrait of Madame X. And that's where the film's title comes from, Madame X. Mm-hmm. And so paintings are a huge theme of the film, a huge visual theme. And Christiane is an artist. She's a painter. And some of her paintings have ended up in Stanley's films, so they were iconically used in A Clockwork Orange and in Eyes Wide Shut, among other films. Anyway, so Christiane and I got in touch, and she invited me over to their home, a very exclusive, private place, which I, again, felt so honored and humbled to go to.
Seriously?
Yeah, absolutely. It hasn't sunk in yet. It has not sunk in.
I'm sure.
And we had a beautiful lunch together. They were extremely generous and warm. I met her brother, a gentleman named Jan Harlan. And Jan was also the executive producer on Barry Lyndon, The Shining, Full Metal Jacket, and Eyes Wide Shut, Stanley's brother-in-law, and sure. Did a huge part to make those films a reality. And during the course of our lunch, we talked about my film, and they have offered me very generously. Christiane has offered me access to her paintings, many of which that actually appeared in Stanley's films, to now be a part of my film.
That is insane.
Yes, it is insane. It's absolutely insane.
Wow.
So yes, her artwork, which is absolutely beautiful. If you want to see it, you can also go to christianekubrick.com and they are available for purchase, but let me use them first, obviously.
Sure.
I have some earmarked, so you guys can't buy everything right away, but they are for sale. There are iconic, beautiful masterpieces that I'm so honored to have in my film as a great way to honor Stanley and Christiane, and without also mimicking. I told Christiane, I said, I don't want to be your husband. I want to be my own guy.
Sure.
But I would love to honor you guys for the huge influence you've had on my life and in my work. So, it's been a very surreal, wonderful experience. His home was absolutely beautiful. It's kind of the mecca of the filmmaking world.
Yeah.
All films from the early 60s on were actually conceived, written, and edited on the property. So I got to be kind of a part of film history a little bit.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and just given access that has never really, really never been given. I'm kind of the only filmmaker that's been given this opportunity outside of Steven Spielberg to have this kind of association with the Kubrick family. And I kind of feel like Rocky Balboa plucked from obscurity.
Sure.
Yeah, I feel like I'm fighting Apollo Creed, out of nowhere, and give him this amazing, amazing opportunity, extremely rare opportunity.
What did you do when you got back to the hotel?
Wept for several hours. Stanley also passed away on the premises, and so it was kind of a somber, humbling experience. Sure. To be in that place. But the home is a supremely creative place. A lot of Stanley's family still lives there, and you can tell that they honor him and cherish the memory of him, and they really grasp his importance to the world and world cinema. Is I don't think they take it for granted. The house is boisterous and artful and beautiful and fun, and everyone's creating, and Christiane's work is all around the home. I was given a tour of the home, which again was just blew my. I thought we were gonna meet at an Applebee's or something. I didn't think they'd ever invite me into the home. Of course, just that kind of candid availability and warmth was not something I expected. But wonderful people, sweet, and then very helpful. They want to be a part of this film in this very beautiful and small way. And I'm just very excited to include them and have the Kubrick name and legacy and in some small way that I can honor it.
That's fantastic, man.
Thank you.
I'm just picturing, your face as you're walking in,
I tried to stay pretty cool.
Yeah.
I really did. There was at one point when I was left alone in Stanley's kitchen, and this was right after a wonderful woman, Tracy, who helps Christian at the home, said, do you know where this table's from? And I said, no, actually I don't. And she goes, it's from The Shining. So Stanley's kitchen table is actually The Shining table.
I'm actually surprised you didn't know that.
Yeah, me too. Right? Well, that's the thing is, I sound like a fanatic, but I'm not really a fanatic. Right, I know what information is available to know.
Sure.
But yeah, no, it was kind of an obscure table. Once I looked at it, I went, oh, okay, I recognize it. When Shelley Duvall's like mixing something in a big bowl, it's right on that table. So yeah, no, it's but just their openness and their kindness and Christian's availability and I just want, she's recently given me some permission to put it up online of her involvement. And so you're actually the very first person I've been able to tell this story to.
Fantastic.
And so I want to thank you for allowing me to let the world know, all of your listeners, and that there is a madamxmovie.com coming very soon where you can see the paintings and you could read more about my experience at the home and meeting Christian. And
that's great. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, thank you. Yes, it's going to be great. It will also be linked directly to her page so you can access her artwork as well. And then there's also going to be chriscranock.com that's finally getting launched simultaneously with the film's website that also has some information about my experience and also has access to more stuff about my filmmaking.
Awesome. Will your new reel be on there as well?
My new reel is up on there. Yeah, kind of new 2018 reel. There's information.
Great stuff.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And then there's also access to my web series, It's All Downhill From Here, which of course has its own site.
Sure.
And it's all downhill from here.tv. You can read weekly comics. We're starting to put up content for that. So I'm staying very busy. And of course, my priority is to make this film, Madam X, put some blood, sweat, and tears in it and honor Christian as much as she's given me, allowed me to.
So yeah.
So pretty amazing.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, looking forward to checking out the site when it's up. And I'm glad we did this episode. I'm glad we were able to talk about Kubrick for for over an hour here.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully people find it as interesting as we do, or maybe sure. I do. I try not to ramble too much. Yeah. But no, it's an excellent film. If you haven't seen this film, see it any way you can, maybe except a cell phone.
Yeah.
If you can see it in a theater, that's what's great about this film. It's so iconic that it does play. This is the 50th anniversary for it, so you can see it in theaters. I think there is a Chris Nolan supervised 70mm playing through in LA right now.
Yeah.
I think it's touring, so you might be able to find it in your local cinema somewhere,
comes here, I'm going to see it again.
Yeah.
Sure.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And it gets better and better. It's a movie you will unpack for the rest of your life. It's a movie that will change as you change, as all great pieces of art do.
Oh, yeah.
So if you want a really amazing experience that changed basically everyone that saw it, go out and take a look at it.
Such putzes in it.
The Pullbag is GCRN's comic book review and discussion-based podcast. Join me, your host, TFG and Mike, and the rest of the GCRN crew as we make our way through the comics we are reading. Inside the Pullbag, you'll also find back-issue classics and origins episodes of how we got into comic reading. You can find the Pullbag every Wednesday on iTunes and on www.geekcastradio.com. Make your great escape into comics and jump into the Pullbag today.
Oh, yes. But think of the fun.
All right. So that's that. 2001, A Space Odyssey. It was awesome to see in IMAX. I think by the time this is up, it will be gone from IMAX. But, I think everybody's been talking about it. So I wouldn't be surprised if they put it back in for a couple more dates here and there. Also, I think that 70mm version that Christopher Nolan restored is still going around making the rounds in different cities. So if you can see it in theaters, go see it in theaters because it's so worth it to see it that way. Especially if it maybe is your first time, like it might have been for me. I'm not sure. I honestly can't remember. But definitely go see it, or at least go get the Blu-ray and watch it. It's a movie worth seeing, especially if you're a fan of all things cinema, sci-fi, anything like that. And I want to thank Chris Cranock for being on the show and for sharing his story with us. It's an awesome story. I'm going to put the link to his stuff in the show notes. That way you guys could check out some of his work. And I'm looking forward to seeing that movie once he starts getting it going, and also the web series as well. So that's it for this week. Well, actually, that's not it for this week, because we will probably have an episode on Friday as well. But I wanted to get this one out right away. And so, yeah, I think there's going to be a two-episode week. We'll see how it goes. This is actually the first time since we started this show that I actually have a few episodes in the can, which is kind of nice. Of course, here I am putting multiple episodes a week, and I'm going to just throw them all out there right away and then get back to where I'm like scrambling for a new episode again. But hey, that's in my nature, I guess. But I'm glad you guys have been out there listening. August was actually our biggest month yet, as far as like downloads and subscribers is concerned. So I really, really appreciate you all out there listening. If you're enjoying the show, I'd love it if you'd rate and review us on iTunes. Also, just send us some feedback directly. You can email me at bydavidrosen@gmail.com. Or you can just tweet at us, you know, at PiecingPod. I want to hear what you think of the show. I want to hear what you think about the puzzle pieces that we suggest here on these episodes. If we think that we left any out, we'd love to hear what ones you think would have been good for us to talk about. Maybe we'll talk about it on a future episode. And I'm really glad you guys are out there listening, but I do want to hear from you, so please get in touch. I'd love to hear who's out there. And I guess with that, we'll close this one up. This was kind of a long one for us, but there was so much to talk about, so it makes sense that it was long. So I'm going to close this one up by... Actually, you know what? I'm going to plug real quick. As you know, I've been promoting my new Palindrome 360 virtual reality music video a lot lately. But before Palindrome 360... I also made a virtual reality music video called Constellations 360. This was a couple years ago with the same developer, New Line Videography. You know what? It fits in well with the theme of 2001, A Space Odyssey. So I'm going to tell you all to go check out that virtual reality music video. You can find it in on YouTube, on Vimeo, on Veer TV, on what else is that thing on? Samsung VR, of course. Pretty much all the big virtual reality video sites you can check it out on, or go to my website, bydavidrosen.com, for links. But check it out. It's a really cool, spacey, trippy, just awesome video. I mean, New Line Videography did such a good job of bringing this trippy idea that I had to life, and it looks really cool. So check it out, and... I think it's probably a little bit inspired by the wormhole sequence in 2001, so that's why I'm mentioning it here. So yeah, check out Constellations 360, also check out Palindrome 360 while you're at it, and I'm going to leave you with another piece of my music, one that also would be pretty well inspired by everything going on in 2001. This is The Void from my most recent album, A Different Kind of Dream.
and all points west.